When I spent a lot of time, like everybody does, driving around with my son, Harry. And, you know, sometimes you feel like you take an opportunity to teach him or reinforce things for him. And I say, Harry, what are the two most important things to know in the world? I said, there's really only two things you need to know. And he says, one, you have to be nice to other people. I said, that's right. And what's the other one? He says, the greatest songwriter of modern times is Bob Dylan.
That's right. That's the other one.
It's all you need to know in life.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Today we sit down with Michael Chaykin, curator of the Bob Dylan Archive and the forthcoming Bob Dylan Center, which will soon be right here in Tulsa, a stone's throw away from the Woody Guthrie Center. Michael splits his time between New York and Tulsa. We talk about Dylan, of course, but also how he and his team are trying to not make a museum. Well, not exactly. Not in the traditional sense, anyway. So one of the things that you've talked about is the fact that the Bob Dylan Center is not going to be the Bob Dylan Museum, and that there is a fairly concerted effort not to make a traditional museum. Mm-hmm. What will make it different than a museum? Because I would imagine most people will walk in, and you can already envision people walking in down the street and say, oh, I'm going to go see the Bob Dylan Museum.
Yeah.
Colloquially, they might call it that. But what will you guys do to kind of keep it from being that?
Well, there's a couple of things that, in a way, kind of predicted that for us, or kind of given us a way in. That is essentially going to make this bit of a non-traditional space. I mean, one is the Bob Dylan Archive itself. So the archive is essentially going to be the beating heart of the Bob Dylan Center. So the archive, for the most part, is in Tulsa, and we've been cataloging it and rehousing it over the past couple years. But it's open to scholars and researchers, but it's not really open to the public yet. So the Bob Dylan Center is going to be the place where, you know, the public is going to have access to this material. It's going to be the kind of public-facing entity of the Bob Dylan Archive. Now, the thing that's kind of setting the tone for the center is the fact that the archive itself and the texture of the archive is, you know, a lot different than other archives that I've been involved with. You know, for one thing, Bob Dylan's archive, it isn't a collection of hundreds of Bob's guitars. It isn't like there's boxes and boxes of stage clothes. I mean, there is some of that. That's definitely a part of the archive. We do have some very interesting objects, like the tambourine, Bruce Langhorne's tambourine that inspired Mr. Tambourine Man. We have the leather jacket that Bob wore when he went electric in Newport. You know, fantastic things, and there's stories around these things.
But this is not like a hard rock cafe,
exactly.
Behind glass,
exactly.
Some cool objects.
Bob Dylan's archive is essentially a record of his working life. You know, a lot of paper, drafts of all of his songs, manuscripts, heavily edited, corrected, many iterations of certain songs. So you really get a sense of this kind of like restless creativity in his process, his working process. You know, the other half of the archive is all of his studio recordings, all of the films that were made on him, including all the outtakes from those films, and also, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of hours of concert recordings. So the archive itself doesn't really lend itself to a traditional museum setup where you would have, you know, a bunch of artifacts.
Yeah, cases with
glass.
Objects.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, and then beyond that, it's just Dylan as an artist and the way that he's presented himself and the way that he's kind of managed his own career. He definitely doesn't seem like the kind of artist that would lend itself to building some sort of a shrine.
Yeah.
Or being kind of enshrined in that way. So, you know, we're not looking to like create, you know, a cult, like the cult of the saints or something like that, where you would have all these totemic objects.
Yeah, it's more about Bob Dylan rather than for Bob Dylan.
Exactly. So, you know, because people are going to be coming to this thing, you know, some people are going to be super fans. Some people are going to be casual fans, and some people are not going to know who, you know, they might have heard of Bob Dylan or seen a picture of him. And look,
it'll just feel like a cultural obligation. They need to go see what it is.
To go see it. And, you know, you can't really please everyone. I mean, the super fans who come, they just want to take all the stuff home with them, you know. But we want to kind of make this thing open enough and flexible enough where, you know, no matter what level you want to, how deep into this thing you want to go. If you want to sit and you want to spend serious time listening to the recordings, you could do that. If you want to spend serious time, you know, looking at the outtakes of a film like Don't Look Back, which was the first feature-length documentary about Bob, that you would be able to do that. Or if you just wanted to kind of, you know, look at things for an hour or so, as you would maybe traditionally go through an exhibition, you could do that too. So we want to have kind of a flexibility.
But that's going to be kind of a very, you know, segmented population of people that want to really... and have the time to do that. Those are people writing books, and that's already happening now. That's been ongoing for the past couple of years.
Yeah, but Bob is, I mean, the one thing that really we have going for us is Bob is such a capacious artist. And when I say capacious, I mean, he's a guy that has ingested so much in terms of high culture, low culture, literature, music. It seems like nothing human is
alien to Bob.
Everything. Yeah, and if you listen to like his radio show or you read Chronicles, it's all there. Like the map.
Pro wrestling, all kinds of
things. It's all there. He talks about how like meeting Gorgeous George was like the key moment in his childhood. And then also in terms of just the number of artists that he's influenced, it's almost limitless. And I think the way to really make this place an interesting place is to not be so focused on Bob, but also show Bob within the context of his times, artists that he interacted with, things that influenced him. And then you've got such a broader sweep.
And legacy.
100%.
So, for example, Tulsa already has the Woody Guthrie Center, and that's in some ways a little bit of a model for some of the ways you're going to be going. They do have this great collection there at the Guthrie Center, but they also do exhibitions about Bob Marley. X, Bruce Springsteen, all these different people that you can see a direct connection to. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about where you'll be able to kind of draw direct lines from Dylan to, say, someone like...
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, we may even go even a little bit further out, and there might be things that seem very tangential. Why would this be happening in the Bob Dylan Center, you know? But we would hope that we would also be able to kind of feature contemporary artists, whether they're painters or musicians, and give them a home in the center that has some fidelity to Bob Dylan. And
like someone like Martin Scorsese, who has been very open about the kind of influence and just the passion for, he's made films about Dylan, you know, someone who's very much a, not just a fan, but a scholar in some ways of his
100%.
Work.
100%. I mean, I know this is going to sound very pretentious, but the way that we've been looking at this is we want to kind of portray Dylan or his legacy or what he's given to us in kind of a cubist way, or, you know, what we're calling like a synoptical view of Bob Dylan and his career, which means no matter, you know, if you're looking at it from one angle, you see one thing. If you look at it from another angle, you're going to see another thing. And... you know, it's a challenge. It's a challenge because, you know, at least initially, you know, the audience for this thing is really Tulsa and the surrounding community, and we want people to come back. We don't want this to be like a one-and-done thing.
Not static.
Exactly. And so the way to do that is we need to have a lot of built-in flexibility. So one of the floors of the Dylan Center will be kind of flexible gallery space where we could have different exhibitions in and out. Some things that we would curate here. You know, if we see a very interesting exhibition somewhere else and say, oh, this would be a really interesting thing to have here, we would have the ability and the flexibility to be able to do that.
Dylan had so many, has had so many different eras, from the early folk Woody Guthrie influence to the born-again Christian phase to the later years where he's doing kind of the Love and Theft and the modern times, but then you also have these other things, you know, the Electric Period, the all these different things where he's touring with the Dead or the Traveling Wilburys period, whatever you want. You could, theoretically do an exhibition chronologically about, you know, all the many faces of Dylan, but it seems like you're not going to do something that obvious. You're going to kind of do much more.
I think sometimes we might do things that are a little bit more on the nose, you know, if you know, there's an opportunity to do something where we could take a deep dive.
Or like the Woodstock years.
Yeah, and take a deep dive into a particular period and show it in a way that's never been shown before. We would absolutely do that. But then there might also be an opportunity to show things that are a little bit more tangential and maybe even a little bit more experimental. And
that's where your role as a curator comes in.
Yeah.
Had you ever been a curator before this? And what does that even mean to you to be a curator?
That's a good question. So I spend half of the month here and then also half of the month in New York. And it seems like in New York, if you pick out your socks in the morning, you're a curator. You know what I mean? It's become like this
fairly
weird,
prevalent.
Yeah. Calling card. You know, I've worked in galleries and, you know, I've never worked in museums per se.
Your background is more management.
Yeah. And film, really. I mean, film archiving is and film programming. When I was in my 20s, I was the director of essentially an art house cinema in Philadelphia. I was very lucky. I got this job right out of school, and I was a very passionate cinephile, and I did that for about 5 or 6 years. And previous to that, I worked as an intern. This was when I was in college. I went to Temple University in Philadelphia at the Harvard Film Archive, and it was like a 6-month gig, but I gained a lot of just practical knowledge and experience doing that. And so when I graduated, I ended up getting this job at this art house cinema. So I was putting together a calendar. It was like a bi-monthly calendar, and you had to program out for like 2 or 3 months. And I was doing it at a time, it was like before Netflix and like DVD hadn't really taken over everything. So, you know, it was a moment where you could like show things and like lots of people would come, you know, because they just didn't have access to things. And at the time, there wasn't much of a repertory scene. I guess if there was like a theater to compare it to in Tulsa, you know, something like the Circle Cinema, we would show new independent stuff and then a lot of classic films and retrospectives. And it was doing those retrospectives, particularly I ended up doing a retrospective of Albert and David Maisels, the Maisel brothers. They're a documentary.
They're famous for doing Grey Gardens, Gimme Shelter, and many other films.
Yeah, and that was really the connection, because I did this retrospective in Philadelphia, and then Albert Maisels offered me a job in New York to help them with their film archive. And as documentary filmmakers, you know, like something like Gimme Shelter, which was the documentary they made about the Rolling Stones at Altamont, yeah, it's a 90-minute film, but you know, they shot the Stones for 2 weeks. So you can imagine the outtakes are
just
like
hours and hours,
hours
of footage.
Hours and hours of footage, which I had the incredible privilege of going through and syncing up and looking at that stuff. But that was like one of 100 films they made. So, you know, it was a serious project. But that kind of archiving experience is what in turn got me working with other filmmakers and writers too. I was working with the Norman Mailer Estate for a little while. I was very interested in Mailer's work, and still am. But in the 60s, he directed these crazy films that didn't really get much play, but I was very interested in them, and just turned out that he was very interested in them too, because he invested a lot of his own money into them.
These kind of machismo films with like Rip Torn and people like this that are kind of stuff that he was doing because he had an itch that needed to be scratched. There was no commercial pursuit.
Well, at the time, you know, in the 60s, it was hospitable for culturally, you know, writers were putting on the director's hat. Like Susan Sontag made films, Alain Robbe-Grillet made films, Genet, Cocteau, all these people. And so Mailer wanted to throw his hat into the ring. And I guess the fulcrum was this film called Maidstone, which he made in the late 60s. Which is probably the closest autobiography that Mailer really ever got. Mm. But he pumped a lot of his own money into these things. So when I came to him with the expressed interest of getting these films out on DVD and showing them, which we did, that, I don't know, it tickled him in some way, or he was glad. I mean, I guess,
because he viewed these as kind of an underappreciated part of his oeuvre.
Yeah, and he felt still, when I, you know, met him, felt very connected to these things. But it just, you know, getting involved with writers and filmmakers and stuff, I guess the takeaway there was like, these people are all really approachable. And, you know, I got lucky in that I was working at this film center, and so I kind of had a venue where I could actually go to a Norma Mailer and say, I'm interested in showing these films in this retrospective.
And reach an audience.
Yeah. And, but, you know, the one thing that I get asked a lot by kids and stuff, like, how'd you get to be the Dylan guy? And I guess the one thing is, like, if you're serious and you have something to offer, and you're not just looking for an autograph, you're not just, you know, looking to, I mean, this is the kind of the issue I have with a lot of curators. A lot of people use the term as like a stamp for their sticker book or something, or just to like fill up a vita. But if you're dedicated and you're serious and you have something, you know, to offer, I've found that a lot of these people are very open and accepting, and they are out there in the world. You know,
it seems like the through line between all this work and what led you to this place that you're in now is just this passion for preserving work that matters.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's film, yeah, whether it's literature,
yeah,
music or whatever. Is there something in you that just has always... What museums mean to you as a kid? Did you go to museums a lot as a kid?
A ton.
What were some of the earliest museums you went to? Did your parents take you to museums?
My dad did, yeah, all the time, every weekend. So I grew up in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia Museum of Art is just mind-bending. It's one of the greatest collections.
This is the Rocky Museum.
This is the famous, so everybody knows it for the steps, but very few people actually go in. But if you're in Philly, I absolutely recommend you check it out. They have, I mean, weirdly, all of Marcel Duchamp's major works are in Philadelphia because his benefactors, the Arnsbergs, lived in Philly. And Duchamp was very close with Brancusi. So some of Brancusi's most important work is also in Philadelphia. So the museums were a big thing for me as a kid. But, I don't know. It was just like an omnivorous curiosity in everything. I mean, to be honest with you, the thing that like really, you know, before like I got real heavy into music and film, I was like, I was obsessed with Mad Magazine. And I grew up in the 80s, and like buying Mad Magazine weirdly was like, and especially looking for like older issues because the humor in it was so topical, and that it would help me kind of understand, well, what came before.
You kind of reverse engineering the 20th century through Mad Magazine
a little bit, and that was like a major thing for me.
Your real teacher was Alfred E. Newman.
Yeah, there you go. But Philly was a cool place to grow up in because of how much of its history, its music history. And
you've been in New York for how long now?
I moved to New York the end of 2005. I mean, I tell people I live in what used to be New York because it doesn't really have the same... I mean, I love it. I mean, it's New York City. There's unbelievable stuff there, but you're kind of overwhelmed by it. And the thing about being in Tulsa that seems to be very present here is there really does seem to be a hunger, an interest in culture across the board. And on top of that, there definitely seems to be a certain lack of cynicism about things that are happening here. That in New York, it's like if the Bob Dylan Archive went to New York or went to, you know, an institution in New York, I think people would get over it very quickly. It would be a you know, big news for a minute, and then it
yeah,
would just...
So, yeah, if the news was the Bob Dylan Museum coming to Brooklyn in 2021, people would be excited. But the question would be, well, how excited would they be in 2023,
yeah,
right? Because yeah, the next big thing would happen. Or what will the Dylan Center being in Tulsa mean to that, as opposed to it being in Minnesota or New York or Austin, yeah, or anywhere
well,
else?
Well, I think, and the way that we're kind of engineering this thing, it's a community center. It's a cultural center. And so Tulsa and the surrounding area is really our key audience. I mean, we want people from all over to come and experience what's been happening.
People will
here
travel from across the country,
100%,
across the world, probably in
but
some cases.
The thing that's really going to keep the lights on in that place is civic engagement with
programming.
100%. 100%.
You have to do things. You can't just
absolutely
be there waiting for people to walk
absolutely
through.
Well, it's almost like running like a movie theater or something like that. It's like every week you check back. What's going on over there? I want to go back. We have to kind of set up an environment where, you know, there's going to be the anchors. So you're going to be able to see the manuscripts. You'll be able to interact with them. We're digitizing everything. There's going to be some of the most unbelievable film and audio components to the center. And those are going to be the anchors for everyone, you know, to come and to sit with that material and engage with that material, however deeply you want to engage with it. But there has to be this whole other kind of ambient thing that's happening there that's going to really kind of keep the energy going, you know, locally, that are going to keep people coming back. Because, I mean, you're going to get the tourists, but they're going to come, you know, once you know, hopefully they'll come maybe two or three times if they have a great experience or they see something that they're interested in coming to see. But I think, you know, there needs to be almost like a
core constituency.
Yeah, there needs to be a repertory fashion. We don't want to keep anything out there too long. And the archive is wide enough and expansive enough that we can move things and we could keep it fresh. And, you know, that's really important for us.
How much did you know about Dylan and his work before you got this gig? And was it important that you were encyclopedic on it before you got the gig?
No, I'm not encyclopedic on it now. I'm learning stuff all the time. And what's interesting is I'm like revisiting a lot of stuff. Like I just recently reread Chronicles, which I had read, you know, 10 years ago.
Volume one of a planned 3-volume set. Yeah. So who knows when those will come out?
I probably knew Dylan as, you know, probably a little bit more maybe than your casual fan, because he was a very important figure for me. I mean, as a kid, I was much more drawn to like more, I don't know, visceral music, like heavy music, Cream, Black Sabbath, all that stuff. But then...
there's no Van Halen archive, though, so...
I wish. There's a guy here in Tulsa that wrote a really incredible Van Halen book, by the way.
But you weren't, like, an obsessive...
I wasn't obsessive.
And that's important, probably. You wouldn't want that person...
Right, because you wouldn't be able to, like, see the forest from the trees. Is that what you would... you know, the thing that really got me into Dylan, and it all kind of came full circle, is they used to show Don't Look Back, the Pennybaker film, on PBS, public broadcasting in Philadelphia, during their pledge drives, like in the 80s and stuff. And that was like the first thing I really saw. And I wasn't like so blown away by the music. I was just very interested in him because it was such an odd, you know, if you've seen that film and you see the way that it unfolds, there's no voiceover narration. It kind of happens almost in like this twilight or something. And the way that Dylan would push back on reporters. Like I guess as a kid, 11, 12, I knew who he was, but I wasn't really aware. But I'd never seen anyone, quote unquote, celebrity acting that way. So it was shocking.
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Outdoor Sculptures. Not coddled and protected like their elitist indoor counterparts, Outdoor Sculptures endure the harshest weather conditions, the abuse of children, and the nonchalant, repeated assessment that they were, quote, made to be outside. The never-ending onslaught of birds attempting to make them all look like Jackson Pollock paintings would prove too much for most. But not for Outdoor Sculptures. They can take all that the world dishes out, and then some. Bring on the heat, bring on the cold. The real snowflakes are inside.
And then later, I really got heavy into the records. Because, I don't know, Dylan is like one of those guys where it's like, you have to kind of have some experience maybe to measure your experience.
I didn't come into it probably heavily and really start going into it until I was at least probably 19, 20, you know, which seems late. But as kind of the voice of the institution in terms of what is seen and what's not seen as the curator of the archive, I wonder, does this center have any critical voice in the sense of, would you ever do a show or focus on a period that would be very upfront about this was not a successful venture, or, you know, this was not a successful period, or is everything hagiography? And
that's a really good question. We absolutely would do that. I mean,
you know, putting in context, like Rolling Stone as compared to Wiggle Wiggle or something along those lines.
No, sure, but
there has to be some level of,
you would have to, right, this whole exercise isn't to praise Dylan. It isn't to over romanticize. I mean, the one thing it isn't, I could say, it isn't a place where we're going to give people hard answers about this, that, and the other. Because we want people, if you tell people what something is about, as if I know, I mean, I don't. But if you give people too much, then they stop looking, I think. They stop digging. They stop searching. So why would we don't want to hit things too hard on the nose. But of course, there needs to be that critical distance. Otherwise, we wouldn't really be doing our job. And you could kill something with praise. You can kill something with overpraise. And
how do you know if something's good if everything's great?
That's right. You know? That's right. And so we got to be very mindful of that, I think.
How do you view this place changing? Because this place is going to be here for a long time.
True.
Will it change, or would it be different now if Dylan was not a living artist? Because he's not involved directly with it.
Right. We would I mean, we do realize that this core group now who are thinking about the Bob Dylan Center and planning it out, we're only the custodians of this thing for a relatively short period of time. And so we have to pass the baton. And this has to be a place that young people want to engage with. And what Dylan means to young people is different than what it means to our generation, certainly the generation before us, where now a kid can just take the whole body of work at once. And so they don't, you know, if you grew up in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, the records were almost like, you know, they were coming out sequentially, and it was like the next chapter in this unfolding story. Now you just go online, you just get the whole body of work at once. So for young people, I don't think they have the same, certainly don't have the same associations mm-hmm. with certain records and certain periods. It's all just this one big body of work. You know, the fact that Dylan is here and he's working, it makes it a living archive. I mean, there's going to be a lot more stuff that's still coming to us.
I would imagine, yeah, because there's an agreement of some sort that you basically acquire more, materials as they as yeah. they're created.
Yeah,
because we should expect more albums and more work.
100%, you know? And we hope that endures for a long time. You know, there was a very interesting article in the New Yorker about the Prince archive that just opened Paisley Park, and you know the thing that struck me about that article, and I guess this is true of, I mean this is kind of an obvious thing, it's true of Graceland too. It is a place where people do come to mourn, and like connect. In a way, with the memory of...
Well, don't you think that Graceland maybe was like that for the first 5-10 years? Well, I mean, Prince just died relatively.
Yeah.
And so people are still raw about it. I would argue that if you go to Graceland now, it's almost as much about the kitsch as it is about anything
Americana.
Else.
It's true, but then you've got Elvis and his parents buried in the backyard.
That's true.
You know, so...
We're not expecting Dylan to be buried in the Guthrie Green, right?
I don't know. There's something... you know, macabre about all that, but I also understand it. It's a very human response. There's a certain need. And the fact that, you know, we are really going to be the only Bob Dylan center on planet Earth. So, I mean, it is going to be a place where people are going to want to come and commune. I mean, we don't want to deprive people of, you know, that experience, which I think is a very powerful one. But we just don't want the whole experience to be that. You know, we do want this to be a celebration of a kind of restless creativity that Dylan certainly embodies, but also a certain American.
And nostalgia is boring.
Yeah.
You know, you want this to be alive. Not something that's always about looking back.
Yeah.
Something about how.
Well, there's something about Dylan, though, that really does speak to the American experience in terms of the fact that he is the self-created individual. You know, there is something still in the American ethos where, you know, where you're born and where you end up, you know, you can escape and you can create and you can mythologize and you could be this whole other thing. And if you're crafty enough and creative enough.
Do you think you still can do now what Dylan did back
then? Sure, 100%. I absolutely believe that there is something in the founding of this country for all of its faults and all of its, you know, problems, that there is something endemic to the American imagination that's much different from other countries that does allow. The fact that I'm here right now in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, from Philadelphia, I mean, there are possibilities that exist.
Yeah,
I mean,
there was
also
no path that could have been foreseen that would have led you here now.
Exactly. You got to take, I mean, again, and I think this is why I admire artists so much and always have and been fascinated by them, is they just take huge risks. You know, there was a moment, I think, in my life where I probably, you know, there was like a jumping off point where I could have like pursued some of these artistic ambitions I had, or I could have kind of stayed the course with like the film programming and all that stuff. And I stuck with the film programming. I'm glad that I did because it led here. But there is some crazy factor that artists have where they do take a huge amount of risk. There's no plan B with a lot of these characters. And, you know, maybe it's romantic, maybe it's foolish, but, you know, I don't have that in me, you know.
This kind of quixotic pursuit.
Yeah.
You're more practical.
I think so. You know? I think so. But I also, like, much like yourself, I do love culture. I do think that there's value in it. And like you said, it's not good to be too nostalgic about the past, but there is a lot that we can pull from our past into the present that will help.
Time you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was.
By all accounts, Bob Dylan and Andy Warhol didn't get along. One of the reasons for this was Warhol's muse, Edie Sedgwick. Rumors have swirled since the 1960s that Dylan had some kind of romantic relationship with Sedgwick, though the extent is unclear. In a 1985 interview with Spin, Dylan said, "I've seen where I have had and read that I have had, but I don't remember Edie that well. I remember she was around, but I know other people who, as far as I know, might have been involved with Edie." According to reports, Warhol would get angry whenever anyone put on Dylan's music, and Dylan didn't like the vibe of the factory, Warhol's studio and gathering place. However, Warhol did talk Dylan into sitting for one of his famous screen tests. After the 3-minute shoot, Dylan allegedly walked over and grabbed one of Warhol's Elvis Presley silkscreen prints, claiming it as payment for his time. Warhol later wrote in his memoir that he'd heard rumors of Dylan using the piece as a dartboard. Later on, Dylan traded the piece to his manager for a sofa. His manager sold the piece at auction in 1988 for $720,000. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.